This is a podcast called Walk, Talk, Listen. An attempt to connect people and make this world a bit better by sharing opinions and experiences based on the belief that everyone's perspective is true, albeit partial. My name is Maurice Bloem, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of Walk, Talk, Listen. Delighted again to have a good colleague and friend of mine, Isabella, and she will introduce herself. And she's an amazing woman. I'm so fortunate to be able to speak with her today. Isabella, can you please introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. My name's Isabella Alexander Nathani. I work as a human rights activist, which I remember us, you know, first crossing paths in that. In that arena, I also do work as an educator, a community educator, and a university educator, a filmmaker, and a writer. I'm trained as a cultural anthropologist. And so I approach all of my work really through that lens and with the goal of using storytelling as a way to find common ground across difference and also to humanize what I think have become some highly politicized political and global crises.
Can you tell us a bit in how you got involved in the work that you do? You know, what's your background? Well, I know you're an anthropologist, but tell a little bit about your life or your career.
Yeah, you know, I actually started my career as a journalist. I was, as I am today, I was originally driven by this desire to seek out stories and to help lift voices, particularly voices that have been marginalized to a front page. I realized after a couple of years of working in that space that what I really wanted to do was find the kinds of stories that often weren't being told. And I wanted to be able to stay with that story long enough to uncover, you know, more and more complex and human sides of it. And that actually what I was interested in doing might be something called anthropology, which I don't even think I knew existed when I was in college. I ended up going back to school later to study that. And with the goal of telling a very particular story, it's, you know, one I've been working on for over a decade now, which is the story of the African migrant and refugee crisis. Those who are fleeing their homes, you know, across the continent, often in goals with the goal of making it to Europe, but having an increasingly difficult time getting there. I just published a book in January of this year called Burning at Europe's Borders, came out through Oxford University Press, which covers these stories, what's happening in North Africa, but also how this is reflective of larger global trends. That book I began doing the research for in 2010, I would say, is really when I was on the ground with the idea of what this book might look like in mind. And I knew even then that I was interested also in capturing these stories in a different format. For me, that different format has always been documentary film. I find that film has a way to connect, you know, to broader audiences and on a more emotional level that can be really powerful, especially when you have the goal of humanizing a story, of creating common difference, of allowing audiences to see themselves reflected back on the screen. You know, you can communicate across linguistic barriers and cultural barriers through film. So I knew that this book was going to be my chance to explore the larger issues, to take a wider view of the crisis, and that the film would be a way for me to zoom in on just a couple of stories and really tell the stories of these individuals and the journeys that they took. So I ended up over the course of 5 years filming with three families from the DRC, Sierra Leone, and Mali, following their journeys over 9,000 miles in all as they attempted to make it to Europe. The film will hopefully be out in January of 2021. So just a month or two away.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
And I mean, just for our listeners, when you're talking about you were following those three families, it also meant that you crossed, you know, from the sea from North Africa to Spain, right? So
yeah, many treacherous crossings involved in the journey that African migrants and refugees are taking today. That final crossing that you describe, you know, over the Mediterranean is only the last in a series of choices they have to make, really, to put their lives on the line to make it, you know, one step further towards reaching their goal of safety on the other side. You know, as an anthropologist, I believe that if you want to tell someone's story well, you have to live it. And so I did live embedded in these communities with these individuals, with their smuggling rings as they traveled, which meant crossing borders between countries and also making, you know, final attempts at escape. The majority of people attempt their final crossing over the Mediterranean, which is only 8 miles at its narrowest point from Morocco to Spain. And there are a number of people who also attempt their final crossing by trying to enter these small Spanish enclaves that are still left in Morocco. And so that entails crossing multiple rings of razor wire fences and facing security forces that have been deployed to push them back.
Yeah. And I would really encourage people to, you know, well, not only to read the book that you've written, but also to watch the movie where I've seen bits and pieces of. I'm really anxious to, you know, watch the full movie. And I will make sure that, folks can read in the notes where they can purchase the book and ultimately see the movie. I have no words for you know, the life that you are able, the lives that you are describing and showing us, and that we as human beings accept that these type of things are happening. So
the stories are quite incredible. You know, I think we have a tendency to reduce these things to numbers so often. So you'll hear about, you know, 75 people drowned just yesterday, you know, off the coast of Libya. You'll hear about several hundred that are, you know, approaching the US-Mexico border in caravan, but we so rarely attach names and individual stories. And that way that we cover the crisis is so dehumanizing. I recognize that it's difficult to imagine things of this scale. Mm-hmm. We've never seen displacement to the scale that we have in the world right now today. It's as much as almost one in every 100 people in the world who have been forced to flee home. It's astonishing, right? Even I have a hard time visualizing what that number looks like. And it's important for us to sometimes allow ourselves to zoom in and think not about the masses, but about the one person, you know, the one mother, the one brother, the one child. And I think then to remember those names, those faces, those stories, and to insert those when we read the really dehumanizing coverage. One of the amazing things about having the privilege of traveling with these three families was that none of them see themselves as being trapped in a crisis. You know, it's just their life. And if you spend that long with someone, you hit all of the highs and lows. So, you know, yes, every single one of the three families lost at least one of their family members over the course of filming over the 5 years. You know, every single one of them spent periods of time imprisoned or in detention centers, was subjected to abuse and rape extortion. But at the same time, they fell in love and got married and there were babies born and they celebrated, you know, the passage of time. That's the thing that I think audiences will come away with when they see the film, is that you really get to travel the full range of emotions with these individuals as they make their journeys.
Yeah. And I can testify that, because, you know, you and I, we were part of a panel together with some other colleagues that we organized at the UN, you know, where we try to emphasize that, you know, it's about names, it's not about numbers. And yes. You know, when you share your stories and show your footage, it definitely hits home. People understand it, and I think in that way we are much more effective in trying to work towards a situation where we really can improve a situation. I'm so thankful for the work that you do.
I end up following three storylines that start thousands of miles apart on the African continent and end up intersecting as they get closer to their goal of reaching Europe. So one is a young family who's fleeing extreme poverty and encroaching jihadist groups in Mali. The mother, Kia, along with her husband, Ja, and their two young children, Mo and Mary. The second is a father named Fino, who has fled an ongoing war in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is known as the Great African War. It's already killed over 5 million. And he leaves behind his daughter and his wife in hopes of sparing them this treacherous journey and reuniting them with them once he safely reaches Europe. And the third is a group of boys and young men who are united by their common experience of having been orphaned by ongoing wars in West Africa. They're fleeing Guinea and Sierra Leone. They're all the eldest sons in the family, and after losing their parents, they have inherited the responsibility of taking care of their younger siblings. So they band together, they call themselves the Brotherhood, and they're trying to reach safety, just like Fino, so that they can bring their younger siblings there, sparing them this treacherous journey that they've had to take.
It's not only about happiness. Yes, there's a lot of happiness, but there's also a lot of hope and laughter well. And I mean, that's, yeah. So thank you for sharing their stories. It's helping me to, you know, to stay
the course. I feel so lucky too, that I'm in, you know, constant contact with these individuals, and, you know, they're a part of my everyday. We talk, we share stories from our day, and it is absolutely impossible for me to allow myself, you know, more than just a few minutes of feeling sad or isolated or lonely or whatever it may be, because I'm so constantly and intimately aware of just how lucky I am, you know. And I think that is a beautiful thing that could come from us creating more bridges, creating more lines of communication, you know, whether that be through the stories that you read and the films that you watch, or whether that be through individuals that you're, you know, in direct contact with. What a gift it would be for every one of us to have someone like that in our lives, who keeps us aware of just how lucky we are.
It seems to be a kind of a weird question, you know. I feel so embarrassed in terms of, because, you know, I walked this 100 mile in a week to raise awareness about hunger and poverty, and, you know, to ask you, why would you walk 100 mile? You have walked thousands of miles. But still, try, you know, asking you, yeah, what would you lift up? And if you would be asked to do this and speak, I think I know the answer, but I still would like to ask you that question. And then the second part is, what drives you in life? So maybe it's related, maybe not. So,
you know, I think it's about lifting the stories of those who have no place to turn. It's about the readers and the audience for at least one moment imagining themselves taking those same steps. So what would you do, you know, if you were this mother with these two young children, what choices would you make? I think it's so important for us to all be able, even for a moment, to step outside of ourselves and to really empathize, to really imagine what it would be like had just, you know, by chance of birth, had we been in a different place, had we been born behind borders, as so many individuals are, and had our life choices been constrained by those borders, what choices would we make? I think that's what the underlying motivation is for me. And, you know, on a larger scale, when I think about the impact that I want this project to have, it is certainly to raise awareness about human rights and to inspire new generations of human rights activists to tell stories in whatever format, you know, they're going to create, which I'm sure is much more innovative than anything that I'm doing now. But also, you know, concretely, a lot of my work is motivated by racial justice. I find that so often at the international level, race is absent from our conversations. And there, as I show in my book and as you see in the film, there is an enormous racial inequity in terms of how our international human rights laws are being applied or not applied to certain populations. And so a really concrete goal that I have is for people to appreciate that race is playing a role in terms of who is granted the right to asylum, when in fact, this should be a human right that's equally distributed across the globe. So, you know, a loftier goal might be to expand access to human rights, to expand our refugee resettlement quotas so that more individuals have the chance to reach safety, which is certainly something I would aspire to. But before we've reached that goal, the limited space that we have for refugee resettlement needs to be equally distributed across racial barriers, and it's currently not. The rejection rate for those who are fleeing the African continent for Black asylum seekers is over 90%.
You know, you, in your capacity as an educator as well as an anthropologist, you deal, have worked a lot with younger folks. So has your observation been around religion and spirituality? And yeah, can you share some of those?
There's such a stark divide that I see between, I do, as you said, often work with younger people. Obviously, as a university educator, I have classrooms full of, you know, 18 to 22-year-olds, but also in the migrant and refugee-dominated spaces that I live and work in Africa, the average age is 16. The oldest in the group is often about 25. So this is a majority youth population, a majority male population also. Their religion in the traditional sense is such an important part of daily life. I see it as something that structures the way individuals make their decisions, the way they as a group make their decisions, and that really structures every piece of their day. In a space where I think the majority of the individuals feel so pushed aside, so forgotten, they have explained to me over and over again how important it is that they hold on to their hope, how their hope is often the only thing that they feel they have. And I really can't think of a single interview I've done where God or Allah has not come up as central to the conversation. This belief that they are in God's hands, this hope that God has something better waiting for them. You'll see in the film, it's really integrated into the way that they understand themselves and their situations. And I think to some degree, it is born out of this lack of alternatives. There's no sense of, you know, in this space that they're now living in, there's no sense of family support. There's no sense of community support. They've lost their friends and they're really holding on to the last thing that they have. And as every other piece of their life falls away, religion seems to become more and more important. It's the only thing left that they have to hold on to. And I think a lot of the individuals who do end up surviving their journeys would reflect back and mm-hmm. say that that hope was really essential in keeping them alive and in keeping them going. In the university classrooms that I work in the US and also in Europe and North Africa, because there is so much support from other structures, from friends, from family, from mm-hmm. community, I don't see that need to hold on to religion or to hold on to the hope that there's a higher power guiding your path in order to survive. I'm largely working with youth who are privileged enough to be in a university classroom, who are safe and who are not thinking about where they're going to sleep that night or where their next mm-hmm. meal is going to come from. And I would certainly say that there seems to be a decline in religious belief in the traditional sense in the US with the university students that I work with.
And when you're saying in the traditional sense, does that mean, are you then talking about linking it with institutionalization? So, you know, the church
yes.
such?
Okay. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I would leave a caveat there that I think there is certainly, this is somewhat dependent on racial background, on socioeconomic background and other mm-hmm. factors particular to the student. So I'm making generalizations. Mm-hmm. But I do find that there is a strong sense of community ethics and community responsibility and what John Lewis would call, you know, our obligation to create the beloved community and to fight good trouble in the name of this beloved community. You know, that is something that in some ways I see young people in the United States at least talking about and thinking about in a way that the migrant and refugee community is not, but perhaps they're both working towards the same goal of creating a better world for themselves and for, you know, their brothers and sisters to live in. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that you see this contrast between, and of course, I mean, when I, in the other podcast, what I always explain is I do realize that when I am asking about to react on youths, you know, that's such a big group and you know, there's so many subcultures and divisions, yes. etc. So, you know, we are aware of that.
You know, I think of myself as an activist first mm-hmm. and foremost, and I see that apply to all of the roles, an activist anthropologist, mm-hmm. activist filmmaker. I push back very strongly on the notion that there's any objectivity mm-hmm. in the kind of work that I do or in anthropology, you know, research, anthropological mm-hmm. research more largely. And as a way to combat that, you know, as you see in the first chapter of my book, I spend the whole chapter addressing who I am as an outsider in this mm-hmm. community and how my position in the community has in every way shaped the research, shaped the book that you're about to read mm-hmm. and how, you know, had the book been written by a man, by a Nigerian, by a Moroccan, it would be an entirely different story that unfolded before you. I always push my students to ask the same question when they pick up a new text in class, mm-hmm. you know, before we dive into it, who's writing this? What's this individual's relationship to the story that's being told, and how is the story going to be filtered through that particular set of relationships that they've established in the community? I attempt to do the same thing in the film by making myself present in the story, or what we would call, you know, breaking the fourth wall. You see me there in the mm-hmm. space, apparent to viewers that I am an outsider in almost every sense. And there are ways in which that status that I have as an outsider, that particular position, enabled me to make this film. There are parts of this story that would have been impossible to tell had I been a Nigerian filmmaker, mm-hmm. for instance. And I think more difficult even had I been a man making the same film. So I do think that everything I'm doing is filtered through my particular lens, and that certainly the actions of those around me are going to be impacted by my presence there. And so I see that as a potential for positive impact, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to impact the community, the individuals, so you can choose how you want to impact them, and you can make every possible effort to ensure that your impact will be positive and sustainable. Mm-hmm. There are lots of instances, you know, over the course of this particular project where I was faced with really difficult decisions about how and when and to what degree I would intervene.
Yeah, I would like to ask you, you know, a lot is going on at the moment in the world, you know, global migration. I mean, you're talking about displacement that's increasing in this country. You know, elections have taken place. We are facing a pandemic. So there are many challenges. What is worrying you at the moment? That's one part. Then the other part, what still gives you hope, or what gives you hope in you know, despite the challenges that we are facing today?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot to be worried about these days. One thing that I worry about in particular is how all of the issues at home in the US are pulling attention away from things that are happening in other parts of the world. And I think it's so critical that we see the interconnectedness of all nations, of all people. And the more that we sort of isolate and insulate ourselves and become absorbed and consumed in what's happening close to home, you know, there can certainly be benefits to that. But I think the challenge is in not forgetting that there's so much happening beyond our borders, beyond our communities, beyond, you know, our own families as well. Mm-hmm. And I see in my own work that it's harder and harder to push people to care about what's happening, you know, far away from home when there's more that feels like it's happening right here on our doorstep. And so I worry about that. And I think that's, you know, a trend that we can see around the world, that with this sort of turn to populism, this turn to nationalism, that people are feeling more and more insulated and isolated and disconnected. And so much of what I do is about making us realize how interconnected we all really are and how arbitrary these borders, national boundaries are. The thing that gives me the most hope has been this enormous rise in activism that we've seen here in our own country just over the past couple of years, I think largely in response to our current political situation into the upcoming, you know, the elections that were upcoming for the past couple of years. It's been really encouraging to me to see young people coming out in record numbers, to see minority populations coming out in record numbers, and to see the diversity of individuals who are joining together with common goals of things like racial justice, of things like, you know, combating the serious problem we have with police brutality, to see, you know, young and old, brown and black and white coming together in the streets for these fights, I think has been really remarkable for a lot of activists who have been fighting, you know, for decades and decades mm-hmm. longer than I have. They're saying, you know, this is the first time it's really felt like a united effort. And that is so exciting. There's so much potential there if people are able to, you know, break down the barriers between us and come together for common fights.
I want to thank you for lifting that up, the interconnectedness. Yeah, between all humans. Yeah, is there anything else, a message that you would like to give to the listeners?
You know, I think the note that we're ending on is such an important one. And as you said, there was hope that this global pandemic would, if nothing else, make people realize that, you know, it won't disappear with just the actions of you and your immediate circle, that the whole world has to come together to fight it. And I think there have been some instances that we've seen of, you know, incredible generosity in communities, but there has also been a lot of, as you said, kind of turning inward, this almost innate desire to protect yourself and, you know, your immediate family, to, you know, to hoard resources, to think first and foremost of the health of those around you. And yeah, to encourage people to think more broadly about how global solidarity is essential, not only if we are going to recover, you know, in terms of the public health pandemic, in terms of this enormous and crippling economic crisis that we're seeing now and that's certain to come in the months following, that we need to come together to fight those issues just like we do, you know, the other most pressing issues of our time, that I'll return us to thinking about the one in every 100 of us who have been forced to walk 100 or many, many more miles in search of a safe place to call home. And, you know, just to imagine if that was you, if that was your children, how would you want the world to receive you? How would you want the world to receive your children, to step out of your comfort for a second and to imagine being in their footsteps?
Thanks for everything you do.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to get to talk about it.
Yeah, no, it's always such a pleasure, and I learn so much. So thank you so much. And I encourage all the listeners to really check out your work, because it's important. And again, thanks, Isabella.
Thank you, Maurice.
Thank you for listening to Walk, Talk, Listen. Please check us out on www.100mile.org or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.